From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's Halloween, so we're talking about horror movies. The historian Scott Poole says there have always been scary stories, but the movie monsters and the idea of zombies and ghosts, all of that came out of World War I, where 38 million people were killed. Poole says artists and filmmakers and writers used the war to fuel their stories of horror, and it's still influencing art and popular culture today. Join us in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the historian W. Scott Poole writes that our monsters are born of our moments in time. And he means literal monsters, the creatures created in films and books in the years after World War I, like Dracula, like The Mummy, Frankenstein's monster. There were horror books and horror movies before that war, but after, they were different. And why? Well, think about it. Think about the newly developed machinery of war at the time, how it created millions and millions of casualties and millions of mutilated bodies. Poole says the so-called Great War placed humans in proximity to millions of these corpses that could not be buried. So how could that not seep into the culture? He says new feelings about death and the macabre needed a place to find expression. In fact, they still need a place to find expression. So filmmakers and artists and writers created monsters. Today in the program, we're talking with Scott Poole about his book that explores the connection between horror stories and the Great War. It's called Wasteland. Poole is a professor of history at the College of Charleston, where he teaches and writes about horror and popular culture. He joined us from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. This isn't his first book about horror and popular culture, but he told us this one was really challenging to write.
I certainly have explored some dark parts of American history in the past because, of course, my general view of horror and history is that they are intertwined, and so that the real horrors of history emerge in our fictions and in our films. This book was very different for me. I must confess, you know, this is not a really wonderful advertisement for the book, but that's okay. I'd like the reader to know what they're getting. That while I continue to love the films that I wrote about, I continue to be fascinated by the directors and the writers and the artists that I wrote about, there was a real sense of identification, perhaps over-identification, with the level of suffering that I was describing. The Great War, as I'm sure we'll talk more about, was really in some sense a apocalyptic event. And so it's not really so many of the individual stories that I go into some great and sometimes I'm afraid harrowing detail about. It's really the sort of sheer cumulative amount of suffering that was global that I think affected me in ways that I did not expect it to. I certainly have always brought a lot of emotion and passion to my writing. I think that historians have to do that in order to communicate the past. We're not just sharing dates and factoids. But there is something about not only the Great War, but the century that followed that forces you to confront a a real darkness, a darkness that seeps in and out of many of the films, many of the fiction that I write about, and also that is just evident in the lives of the people who created these works of art. And it's possible that one thing that makes this book very different is that, you know, I did really closely follow a number of individual figures from their lives before and after 1914, all the way into the 1930s, in some cases, all the way to their deaths later in the century.
You write that in every, and we'll get to a number of them, by the way. James Whale, in particular, Walter Benjamin will come to, and others. You write that in every horror movie, in every horror story, every video game, you can find the phantoms. This is how you put it: you can find the phantoms of the Great War, and you've even said that the Great War, this is how you put it, tore a hole in the world that hasn't really ever been repaired. We'll dig into this as we go, but broadly explain that. What was it about the Great War that tore a hole in the world that made it so significant, so different?
I think that it is almost impossible for us to truly relive the mindset of 1914, 1915, as people began to see what the Great War was going to be. The illustration that I have used before is it is as if we had 9/11 every day for the next 4 years, or perhaps something even more cataclysmic. We were to wake up tomorrow morning and learn that dirty bombs had exploded in most of the world's major capitals. It was a level of violence that was not only unprecedented, and much has been written about that, much has been written about the numbers involved, but I think that what goes along with that is there had to be, it was actually forced on people of the moment and later, a conceptual change in the way, really, that they thought about the world. I think that there is a sense in which horror for the last 100 years has kept replicating that sense of catastrophe. And I believe that part of the reason that this is actually true is that the sense of history as a series of catastrophic events, something that we all feel, you know, when we look at our news feeds every day, this really begins in 1914 to 1918 and the ripple effects over the last 100 years.
You know, I wondered, you say in the book that, of course, there were horror films from the start of people making films. This was before a Great War. But you say a new kind of film came about in the years following the Great War. And I wanted to get a sense of, and we will talk about corpses and bodies because I think that's a really important part of this. But it made me wonder, why not after the Civil War, for example, did you see that kind of stuff? I mean, there were lots of rotting corpses in fields then too. And I just, give us a sense of the difference, do you think?
I think the major difference between the aftermath of the Great War and really the other largest conflict that anyone had ever known about, the American Civil War, had to do with the loss of sentimentality for the dead. And it is true that following the Civil War, and I mentioned this, that there was a interest in, for example, the crime genre. America has its first serial killer in the 1890s with H.H. Holmes. There's an interest in the idea of the crime scene, some of which grows out of Civil War photography from the Matthew Brady studios. But I think that one of the biggest differences is that those bodies were buried. those bodies continue to be sentimentalized in often really very elaborate funeral rites, so elaborate that they seem almost morbid to us today, but were not morbid at the time, were in fact ways that people dealt with the loss of their dead loved ones. That becomes impossible after the Great War. And I think one of the things that was most striking to me that I really did not know, at least at the level that I came to know it later, is just really how quickly in Western Europe, almost a century and a half of burial rites, funerary rites, they really just disappear overnight. And I think that this creates a new kind of horror film that needed to respond to a new kind of trauma.
Bodies, corpses in particular, are interesting. You mentioned how no war fought before 1914 had created so many, and part of this was just the proximity you write about. It placed human beings in proximity to millions of corpses that you couldn't have rights for, or at least not right away. They were there rotting, as we said, in fields, and many of them unrecognizable, really mangled by the machinery of that war. That seems really a distinction, something that was different.
It's absolutely a distinction. I mean, you know, soldiers become distinctly unsentimental about the corpses of their comrades because it's something that is forced upon them. You know, we have to keep in mind that on the Western Front, for example, there are places where, you know, the front lines of Allied and Central Powers troops are separated by 100 yards, 300 yards, 600 yards. You know, they're close enough that they can see their comrades tangled in barbed wire. There's no easy way after a assault to dispose of the bodies, some of which had been dismembered in ways that no one could have really imagined before, because the Maxim gun, the Vickers gun, the machine gun, field artillery, field mortars, these really did things to human bodies that no one had ever imagined, to the point that they became unrecognizable as human bodies. And as you said, you know, I don't think there was another time in history, I mean, including thinking back to the 14th century and the Black Death, where for such a long period of time you encountered corpses day after day after day, not only in no man's land, this wasteland in between the trenches, but within the trenches themselves. There's just no way to easily dispose of these bodies or what's left of these bodies. And so you have the phenomenon of mass graves, unmarked graves, graves that read simply a soldier of the Great War, known only to God, or simply, often in French, just unknown.
And so how did that manifest itself in the few years that came after the war? I mean, you mentioned we could start talking about films like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or Waxworks, where we start to see these just kind of empty shells, right? Is that how it – talk a little bit about that.
Of course, yes. So I think that this marks the definitive change in horror between really what came before 1918 and what came after, because there is a fascination in films ranging from the first great vampire film, Nosferatu, in 1922, Paul Lenné's Waxworks in 1924, with the idea of bodies that are simply empty husks, empty mechanisms. This plays a really important role in the German film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, where Cesare, the murderer, is a somnambulist, a sleepwalker, that at least we think at first is under the control of a kind of magician, mad scientist, Dr. Caligari. And he moves about with really no noticeable humanity behind his eyes. This image, which is both an image of a corpse and an image of a traumatized person, would have been deeply recognizable to soldiers and civilians, a point that I like to try to emphasize after the Great War. The audience for these new kinds of horror films are veterans who survived, many of them wounded veterans, but also their families, civilians who had suffered wounds, civilians who had suffered bodily mutilation. Civilians suffered enormously during these wars, during the war. There may have been 20 million civilian casualties, deaths, and very often very severe wounds. And so this created a what is best, I think, thought of as a kind of audience for trauma, and worked in a way because even when the films, although sometimes they did address the war directly, even if they only addressed the war in a kind of oblique fashion, there was no way that the sort of obvious resemblance to loved ones who had come back traumatized and silent, loved ones who had never come back at all, that in sort of the cinema of madness, cinema of horror, cinema of the dead body come back to life and for very malign purposes, there's no way that would have been missed. And I found a significant amount of evidence that directors didn't want audiences to miss it, directors, cinematographers, and writers of these new films. And I call this the birth of modern horror, not just because these are films in the 1920s and 30s, but because this has remained a perennial fascination of the horror film. Not simply the body revived, the body that shouldn't return that does, but also the body as a kind of frightening mechanism. My students, I'm currently teaching a course on the Great War and horror. My students automatically, without being pushed in this direction, saw a resemblance between Cesare in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Michael Myers in the original and the more recent Halloween. Both these just sort of empty, dead-eyed, we don't have a real explanation for why they're doing what they're doing, absolutely murderous and seemingly unstoppable.
That's W. Scott Poole. His book is called Wasteland, The Great War and the Origins of Modern Horror. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, since it's Halloween, we're talking about horror movies and our fascination with them with the historian Scott Poole, who says artists and filmmakers and writers used World War I to fuel their stories of horror. His book is called Wasteland, The Great War and the Origins of Modern Horror. Let's talk about, you mentioned Nosferatu, the 1922 German film. I wanted to ask you more about that because I think it's so interesting that this, of course, was an unauthorized adaptation of Bram Stoker's novel Dracula. And you write about in the book about how people became really obsessed with this film, not just because it seemed to have some really kind of cool stuff. I mean, there were these color plates that came along with the screenings that must have been amazing for the day. So that sounds really interesting. But that wasn't the essence of the obsession, it seems like that. I mean, there were, you talk about how these young surrealist painters loved the film. It was almost like they would go to it like, you know, we used to go to Rocky Horror Picture
right.
Show. I mean, we knew all the lines and we would
yes.
dress up like the characters.
Absolutely.
And what was the fascination over that film?
Yeah, and I should add that they dressed up like the characters as well. And just like at Rocky Horror would, you know, when the intertitle cards came up, you know, they had memorized them. They would shout it at the screen as if it was that. So I think that one of the important things about Nosferatu is just it really was an absolute blockbuster, particularly for a film that did not have an especially long run in just in Germany at the time, because in fact it was something of a ripoff of Dracula, Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, and even though there are some very significant differences, and the Stoker estate in fact sued the production company and put it out of business, but the fascination even with the short run of the film, I think, had to do not so much really with the really kind of startling appearance of Count Orlok or Nosferatu, the monster himself, as much as the idea of a powerful force, which he represents in the film, that brings death and brings death on a great scale. Das Gross Sterben is what it was called in German, and the phrase is actually used in the film. It's a phrase that in Germany had been used for the Great War, and it's very hard to translate into English. It actually means something like the great die or the large die. It is usually translated as a great death or the Great Plague.
So it's not just a traditional vampire movie.
It is not at all.
It's about the apocalypse, basically.
It is really a apocalyptic film in many respects. Count Orlok does not go sort of from bedroom to bedroom biting necks. There's a bit of that, especially at the end. But the real terror of Nosferatu is as a bringer of death on a great scale. And Alban Graw, who was responsible for parts of the story, the set design, even the design of the monster itself, working with director F.W. Murnau, he actually said that the war was, or rather that the film was essentially a representation of the war that he had experienced. He talked about the war as a cosmic vampire that had devoured the blood of millions, something monstrous that had emerged in the 20th century. And so from his own perspective, this is what he wanted the people of Germany to see in Nosferatu. And I think that particularly given that it appears in 1922, we're just a few years after the armistice and then the Peace of Paris in 1919, those connections are most certainly made.
Well, as you mentioned before, there are a lot of characters that we meet in your book of people who had gone through the war, the Great War, and how this was reflected in the art that they created, the films they made, the books that they wrote, the essays they wrote, which brings us to Walter Benjamin, who you've talked about as kind of serving as an inspiration for the book. Let's talk a little bit about who he was. You mentioned the beauty and the depth of his essays, really deeply complicated. Talk a little bit about what Walter Benjamin, who he was, first of all, and what he was saying about war.
Well, Walter Benjamin is, to me, really one of the more interesting characters of the early 20th century. He had actually avoided service in the Austro-Hungarian army, and really spent the next 20 years almost trying to understand what had become of Europe in the aftermath of the Great War, and also really very prophetically very, very darkly in many respects, predicting the rise of fascism. And then himself becoming kind of a victim of fascism. One of my favorite essays of his is called The Storyteller. And he actually talks about the veterans of the Great War. And this is something of a paraphrase, but he says something along the lines of that men had returned from the battlefield poorer in communicable experience. They had less to say than they did before, and that although, you know, as time passed, there's this flood of war books, there's not a willingness to speak of it, to speak of the horrors that people experienced. And it's actually from Benjamin, other than the films themselves, that I began to think about this idea of what the human body had been exposed to, the threat to the human body during the war itself. It's a very moving passage. Benjamin writes about a generation that they had been to school on a horse-drawn streetcar, and they suddenly found themselves in a countryside where everything had become unchanged, had become a kind of wasteland. And in this, you know, field of destructive torrents, shells, explosions, there's the what he calls the tiny, fragile human body. And I think that Benjamin really manages to, in a sense, almost because he didn't participate directly in the Great War, he's the diagnostician of it. He's the one who was able to say, this is what it meant, and this is what it is going to mean. He is quite prescient about the rise of fascism, something that even though he is able to flee Germany after the invasion of France, will eventually lead to his death.
You mentioned Walter Benjamin talked about how we need to write about that war with as much bitterness as possible, and you say in the foreword that that's what you're trying to do. You're wanting to impose that kind of bitterness on the way you're perceiving that great war.
I did. I have to say, you know, going back to our earlier discussion, I think this is part of what it made the book so difficult to write. You know, I think that anybody who has read Monsters in America or some of my other work on Lovecraft or the horror hostess Vampyra, I mean, they know that I'm a, you know, they know I'm a horror nerd. I mean, they know that I'm a fan, you know. You know, in confronting this material, there is really no way to completely pull apart, really, as you described it earlier, the sort of wonder of a film like Nosferatu, the incredible, you know, effects that people like Murnau, Lenny were able to employ to really pull that apart from, you know, the sort of vast human suffering that the war created in those 4 years, but also as the book talks about the ripple effects of that ever since.
Well, and we'll come back to this because your contention is that we're still experiencing that ripple effect. It's not really over. We're still feeling the effects of that. We'll talk about that in a moment. Let's talk about James Whale. I was fascinated by him. He's of course, the director of of the film Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, which we'll talk about
Absolutely.
As well. But Whale, a second lieutenant, served in the British Army in Flanders, saw some pretty terrible stuff. You talk about the war had been a desperate one for him. Talk a little bit about – you talk about how Whale developed this obsessive concern over the creation of the monster in Frankenstein.
He absolutely did. And, you know, this is possibly going to be a somewhat controversial part of the book and a somewhat controversial claim, particularly for many sort of hardcore 1930s horror fans, as I am myself. I actually strongly believe that Whale took an enormous amount of concern with the creation of the monster, much like Alban Grau and Nosferatu. Now, generally, and I think he does deserve some credit, Jack Pierce, the great, incredible Jack Pierce, who designed so many of, you know, the classic monsters of the 1930s and indeed of the 1920s as well. He's generally been given credit for the effects and the design of Boris Karloff's makeup. And I in no way, and I hope in the book it doesn't suggest that I diminish his importance. But, you know, Whale was known for doing sketches of everything from the design of the monster to the way that Frankenstein's castle would look. I found sources talking about how he would scribble on the back of scripts, how, you know, everything from furniture to curtains should look like on the set. So he really, and he had a great deal of experience with this. He often acted as kind of his own art director in many ways. And I think that his experience in the Great War, which so many of his most important films, certainly his horror pictures, but the war films that he made as well, show an almost compulsive interest in representing death. And I think he took on the assignment to do Frankenstein with such elan in 31 because this gave him the opportunity to design a monster that was not only a representation of the dead, but of death itself in some ways. I make the point in the book that although he may not be very frightening to us today, you know, we think of Frankenstein's monster that's been used to sell everything from hamburgers to cereal, and, you know, he's just kind of this friendly square head. But in 1931, and if you watch the film with unjaded eyes today, you realize that you're really looking at a kind of walking mound of corpses.
Yeah.
These are parts of bodies, this is in some ways more terrifying than sort of the modern, you know, reanimated zombie idea. And, you know, I think that Whale felt, as he did in his Great War pictures, a sense that, you know, he was almost kind of compulsively, you know, using this language of trauma.
It's interesting, the studio executives in those first screenings of Frankenstein, they were really worried that he had maybe been too on the nose with this thing, and they wanted
him
to
change it. Oh, my goodness, yes. They were horrified at, and not in a good way.
Right.
So actually, it was an anniversary this week. Film Frankenstein premiered to kind of a test screening on October 29th, 1931. And Whale was there, along with his romantic partner, David Lewis, but also Carl Lamely Jr. was there, who was the son of studio head Carl Lamely of Universal Studios. And they were really horrified at the audience response. Members of the audience kept getting up, walking out, coming back, getting up again, coming back. There was no applause that followed the screening. Nobody said anything to Lamely. Nobody said anything to the director. Nobody congratulated them. They just sort of filed out of the theater. And apparently, you know, Lamely Jr. just said, "We have he exclaimed something like, you know, "We have a disaster on our hands." And Whale seems to have understood what had happened better. I mean, I think that the audience was just stunned into silence by what they had seen. And I should note that what they had seen is different from the cuts of Frankenstein that you'll see today. The original ending of Frankenstein ends really in silence. The monster burns in the windmill, very famous scene. It appears Henry Frankenstein, he's called Henry in the film. Henry Frankenstein has died. The monster's thrown him from the mill. And then the camera kind of pulls back, and all you hear is the crackling of the fire, the howling mob. The mill collapses in on itself. No music, roll credits.
Wow.
That's it. And it's one of the things the studio made Whale change. They thought that, you know, it needed a, you know, a sort of, quite literally a Hollywood ending.
Yeah. It's interesting. It was a hit. I mean, and you mentioned
it was a huge hit.
It was a hit in Germany.
It was, you know, no, it's very quickly by 1933, it's banned.
Yeah.
In Germany. It's a hit in Great Britain, although Great Britain has always had very, all the way into actually the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the UK has had interesting censorship laws, and they apparently chopped Frankenstein into kind of unrecognizability. People had trouble making sense of it, and yet still loved it. But I think that I'm hoping that one of the things that happens when people read this book is they'll go back with some of these ideas, think about, you know, what people are thinking about in the context of 1931, see it through those eyes, and I think it's going to be, I hope it's going to be a whole new experience of films like Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and even, you know, I'm aware people have different feelings about silent films, but I'm hoping that, you know, after a screening of Nosferatu, I think that many modern audiences will find themselves quite unsettled by it.
I wanted to ask you about it seems like the most iconic monster film of all time, King Kong, made by Marion Cooper.
Yes.
Cooper drew directly from his experience in the Great War to create that monster as well.
He absolutely did. This is actually something that before I did any research at all on the book, I simply was not aware of. But Cooper had experience in the war as an aviator. And this may go to explain sort of that final, you know, very famous scene in King Kong where, of course, the monster is circled by biplanes, falls to his death. There's that sort of brief moment of both relief and sympathy that is given to the monster. I think it's also interesting with King Kong that, which I've written about before in kind of a different context, thinking about it more just in the context of American history. But it really struck me this time thinking about Kong that, you know, there are so many stories floating around in both in film and in fiction of sort of and in poetry of dark cities and cities of death. And there's a way in which, of course, Fritz Lang's Metropolis is like this. And the idea of taking the monster and setting them down in the midst of a city and making that an image of just, you know, absolute explosive violence. I think is an incredibly interesting idea. I should mention also that Miriam Cooper, in working on the film and actually in the famous sequence with with the biplanes, his fellow veteran, Ernstby Shostak, who had worked with the Signal Corps, had his eye, part of his eyesight badly damaged, actually works with Cooper on that iconic scene. So even, you know, one of the great, you know, very, very American horror films of the 30s, you have veterans of the Great War behind it.
We're running out of time, but I want you to say something about The Bride of Frankenstein. This was in 1935, which you call James Whale's masterpiece. And I thought it was interesting that you say in some ways he sort of conceived it initially as a comedy.
So he referred to it as a hoot.
Yeah, a hoot, right.
Which is, of course, a word that we still use with a slightly different meaning. What he meant by that is a comedic parody with a acerbic edge to it, a dark edge. And so he thought of it, and I am partially quoting Christopher Bram, who wrote a sort of fictionalized account of Whale's final days. He refers to it as a comedy about death. And both of those things are maintained. There are moments in the film that Whale means to be quite funny. The response of some of the characters, famously Una O'Connor's character to the monster, sort of screaming and running around in circles and that sort of thing. But there is a darker side to it. To me, as much as I love The Bride and those final few minutes when we get to actually see the Bride of Frankenstein at last, and she's this extraordinary Art Deco architectural representation of monstrosity, to me, in a way, kind of the center of the film is the scene in a crypt in which Dr. Pretorius, who is sort of urging Dr. Frankenstein to pick up his experiments once again. Dr. Pretorius, played by Ernest Thysiger, who himself was a veteran of the Great War and records some of his horrific experiences in his memoir. He's actually shown being very comfortable eating his lunch and drinking a bottle of wine on top of a tomb. And a skull is sitting beside him. And it's actually right before the moment that Frankenstein's monster enters the crypt to meet Dr. Pretorius for the first time. And Pretorius raises his glass not to Frankenstein's monster, Boris Karloff, but rather to the skull. And he says and laughs, "I give you the monster." And so to me, this is the center of the film because the monster is death. The monster is the great death, to go back to Nosferatu, that both Thysiger and Whale had confronted in the trenches on the Western Front.
You mention in your book that we're fascinated by horror. And there's enormous amounts of horror these days, books and essays and all of those kinds of things. And a lot of this, you say, relies on what is called the mirror argument, you know, that a horror film reflects the anxieties of the moment. And it's true, of course, in some ways. But you also say that it's actually more dangerous than that. Talk a little bit about that part, because I found this really interesting. It's deeper than just revealing our anxieties. There's something more dangerous at foot.
It is deeper. It is not simply a sort of psychological reflection of what we're afraid of at the moment. It's more than an experience of catharsis. Often horror is spoken of in those terms. I think that from some of the examples from the Great War, many of the examples today in which we see, for example, more and more films that focus on horror on the digital frontier, what up-and-coming scholar Daniel Powell calls techno-horror, social media, bots on social media, even the role of foreign agents on social media interfering in our democracy. And then we have a rash of films that deal in various ways with the terrors of that world, the Unfriended series, films like Friend Request or Search, or new kinds of monsters like Slender Man, or conspiracy theories that circle around things like the computer, the PC horror game, Five Nights at Freddy's. And I don't think that we can really sort of pull apart the experience that we have when Twitter, Facebook, what have you, makes us desperately uncomfortable, and the experience that those films are relaying. They are part of the kind of world of meaning that we are stumbling around in. And I think that that was true for the veterans and the civilians that survived the Great War and saw those first modern horror films in the late teens and early 20s of the 20th century.
Well, horror films gave way to slasher films, gave way to the films that you were mentioning. And you talk about how it just has stayed with us because, and this is an argument you make in the book, that the war isn't really over, that all of those conditions in some ways are still in place. What does that mean, that we haven't really resolved that? We haven't ended those conflicts. We haven't come to terms with all of that.
It is very difficult to look at any area of the world in which there are, seemingly intractable political, military conflicts, social conflicts of various kinds, that in one way or another, the Great War did not, and its aftermath did not unleash on the world. The easiest example, I think, to give is to just point out that really the Paris peace treaties of 1919 essentially create what we now call the Middle East. And so there's really not a sort of flashpoint around the globe. There's not a problem that we are dealing with in our own country that in some ways doesn't have its beginnings in that era and in the era immediately following. I have this sense that the Great War created the modern world and destroyed the modern world at the same time, that it truly was a apocalyptic shift, not only because of the numbers of deaths and casualties involved, but because it's never been really possible for us to think about or experience the world in the same way again.
I was really saddened by what you reveal happens to Walter Benjamin and James Whale. Walter Benjamin has to flee Germany, and then he has to flee Paris, and then he tries to travel into Spain from the Pyrenees, and he's stopped, and he gets despairing, and he kills himself. And James Whale commits suicide much later than that, 1957. But this was so interesting. You tell the story about how a friend of James Whale's said that in his final years, he had taken to staring into mirrors.
Yes.
Would you say something about that, finally?
Certainly. It was something that moved me a great deal that, in his final days, he told a friend of his, Glady Lacey, who had worked with him in the theater, that he had taken to staring at himself frequently in mirrors. And this struck me, first of all, because mirror images and reflections are sort of these, as they are today, it's one of our heritages from this era. They're portals of horror. It's dangerous to stare into them too long. It's dangerous to say certain things in front of them. And this is something that goes all the way back to the 1920s. And it's an idea that Whale had used in The Bride of Frankenstein, his film The Old Dark House. And on one particular day, not long before he did at an advanced age commit suicide, Whale told Lacey that he had taken a look at himself in the mirror And he said, I realized that I had created Frankenstein and that it has become a nightmare to me. I launched a horror into the world and I could not stop it. And he says that looking into the mirror, he realized what he had done. I think that the reason that that is so poignant is that I feel that because of other things we know about Whale, that in a sense he's actually not talking about the film there, but rather his own memories of the Great War that he had invested so many of his films with, and that in the final days of his life really came flooding back to him as he struggled more and more with, I believe, what we would now label, you know, PTSD, and used various tranquilizers to even, you know, try to sleep in the night. And so he's still in those final days and possibly in his final moments was very much still in the trenches.
Scott Poole, he's a professor of history at the College of Charleston. His book is called Wasteland, The Great War and the Origins of Modern Horror. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.